in most South African maps, you can't find the townships. So, for example, most maps of South Africa have Johannesburg, but I think fewer, about a million people, and does not have Soweto on it, which has 5 million people, because Soweto has black people in it, and Johannesburg is white. So the maps of South Africa are very strange. We all purchased the people's map of South Africa, which had all the townships on it, because many of the places we went were black townships. So it was a very strange kind of adjustment to be in a place where for centuries or over a century, black people had officially not been citizens and hadn't really been even acknowledged to exist, when of course they're 85% of the people. So there was a lot of kind of shifting of consciousness that we did in our head, because it was such a strange thing for us in lots of ways. I'm going to tell stories about different days that I had while I was there and show pictures of the days. So I've just picked out 5 or 6 different days of the trip, and I'll show you slides from those days. And you should interrupt me at any point for discussion and questions. We'll just continue with the slides, and then when you have anything you want to say, just say it, and we'll talk about it, and then we'll go on to the next thing. So I'll turn out the light, and we'll start. The first day we were there, we went to a school, and it's the school that was the beginning of the rebellion against using the language Afrikaans originally. So there's a real history in this school of the children claiming their rights as full citizens, and consequently this school is the target of a lot of violence on the part of the police, and I can show you some pictures of that. But the kids were wonderful. There are 1,300 children in the school. It's in Soweto. There are, I think it's 15 teachers. And so every classroom doesn't have a teacher all the time. But when we went there, every classroom was quiet and orderly, and the students were studying. And 15 of the classrooms had teachers in them, and the rest of them didn't. And the teachers rotate then from class to class, and the students study. The children were, of course, wonderful, and they were charming. And when we would walk into the room, the 10 of us, 7 of us were white and 3 of us were black. We'd walk into the room, and the children would all scramble to their feet and look attentively at us, because we were grown-ups and we'd entered the room. And so we would say good morning, and they would say good morning, and then we would ask them if they would like to sing, and they would sing something for us, and then they would ask us if we would sing, and then we would sort of stumble around and look embarrassed and say, well, no, actually, we didn't think we would. Oops, that must be the wrong way. Yeah, here we go. So this is a few pictures of this school. The garbage is entirely dealt with through in all the townships, just through burning, so they constantly have a fire of garbage going. And they grow things in the school for the kids to eat. The condition of the school is like this everywhere. But the kids are fabulous.
What ages are the children?
They are through, I think, sixth form.
And begin at?
And begin quite small, like 7 or 8 years old.
What's the purpose of white cleats or whatever it is?
Of the white, that bag?
No, I mean all the flag.
Their shirts, they have on white shirts.
Oh.
All the kids in South Africa wear uniforms to school. And the girls sit on one side of the class and the boys on the other. And that's it. Every classroom was like that. The habit has been in South Africa for years, oh, I've got these slides in backwards. And I'm sorry, I did that this morning. It says right here, stop rape. The government in South Africa for years has displaced people, you know, and forced, especially men, to move into what they call hostels, which are like dormitories in clusters near cities, and then they work there, and they live in those hostels. And that's been a pattern that's gone back, I don't know, 20 or 30 years in South Africa. And so it separates families, and then 1 month out of the year they send them home, and then they hope that they'll get their wives pregnant, and then they come back again. So now the government, the white government, has armed most of the hostels around cities to foster and create unrest. The government provides them with AK-47s, and so the hostels are the source of much of the black-on-black violence. And there was a hostel very near this school, and the government would actually pay these men living in the hostels alone without their families to do violence. And so sometimes the hostelers would come over and do violence against the school, and they also did rape. And the kids in the school were very upset about this, so they were trying to fight back.
Are there many children killed?
Oh yes, constantly. And in this school there have been over 100 children killed. So it's a very bitter situation. Now, my slides again, as I said, are backwards, and I apologize for that. But this is a phrase that's in their, looks like the People's Declaration of Independence, and it says, open the doors to learning and culture. And it's a phrase that you see painted as graffiti on walls, you see it everywhere, because the people feel so strongly that learning and culture is one of the things that they are being cut off from through apartheid.
Now they're learning English in school.
Yes, they've chosen English as the language they want. They don't want Afrikaans, which is the language of the oppressor in their view. And they want to have a common language. So we were speaking with a university president in Johannesburg, and he said that it was interesting that the blacks, it's a very progressive university because they admit black students. And he said the black students who come all know five languages. They know English and Afrikaans, they know their own tribal language, and they know two other tribal languages from nearby tribes. And the white students who come know two languages, English and Afrikaans. But English is really the language of the country. Now there is, in backwards, it says, why rape? And the children have written, you know, trying to figure out why this is going on. This was their library. The laboratories, the library, the teacher's office, the offices, the principal's office have all been destroyed, and the bricks have all been stolen so that people can build themselves. Once the content of the classrooms was destroyed by the people from the hostels, then the people in the neighborhood who are homeless come and take the bricks to build themselves homes with. So this is the library. At the beginning, if you've seen the movie Serafina, the opening scenes of Serafina with, what's that famous actress who's in it, a black actress, I can't remember her name. Anyhow, the opening scenes are filmed at this school. Open the doors to learning and culture. Oops, sideways. Sorry. I obviously should have done this slideshow ahead of time. I put all these slides in the thing this morning and didn't check it. Then we went from that school on the same first day we were there to a nearby squatter community, which they call informal communities. The government calls squatter communities informal communities, which I think has got some strange charm to it. I can't get this to stay in focus, I'm sorry. See, the automatic focuser is on. But this was, I'm going to turn off the automatic focuser, I think. Should I bother?
No.
There.
Okay.
This
squatter community is one of the best-run squatter communities in the country. It's much more orderly than some of them are. You can see that the street is fairly straight down this particular street in it. It is run by the local civic association. And the civic associations in South Africa are what the black folks have formed to govern themselves so that they don't have to have much to do with the white government, so that they don't constantly have to interact with the white government. So this community has an elected president who's the head of the civic association, and he was our guide through the community. So we learned a lot and enjoyed him and had entree to the community because of him. One of the ways you can see that it was well organized is that the streets and paths were fairly straight. And another way is that you could see that the houses had numbers on them so that that you could locate them. It was like having an address. It was an address, which not all squatter communities have. As you can see, most of the buildings are made out of found materials, whatever people can patch together. This is the president of the Civic Association and his wife, and he lives in the squatter community too. He was given a suit to wear so that he could look appropriate for his position as the head, the elected official. And his wife told me, in an aside, while we were visiting in their courtyard, or their dooryard, that every night she washes and starches his white shirt so that he will always walk around the community looking appropriately dignified. But they were wonderful people. And he told us such interesting stories about what it's like to be the president of this huge squatter community, many thousands of people, which has elected to have nothing to do with the official government. So that the official government doesn't know about births and deaths here. They don't get called if there's a police or fire incident. What they want to remain as completely anonymous as they can. This was a little informal store in the community that this couple was making their living by selling stuff to their neighbors. Here was a lovely man who actually sang a song for us, and this is his home with the plastic over the top, and he was a very interesting guy. We took a one of those cameras that you can take immediate instant pictures with, you know, and we took a picture of him and gave it to him, and he liked having that. But he wanted to have all of us in the picture with him so that he would be reminded of what this day was like when we came through the community. There's some of the kids. And see, that's one of the really well-built buildings. That's the top of the line in that community. Whoops, I'm sorry. There's some kids. There's another informal economy, part of the business of that community, with somebody selling stuff. And now this man was telling us another story. He said that not long before we were there, one man killed another man in this community. And he was told by his advisors and the members of the community that he was fully justified in putting the killer to death. And so he had to decide, he was the judge and jury and executioner in that case as the president of the civic association. He had to decide what to do. And he made up his mind that if he put that man to death, he would then have two widows, two families of children, and two funerals to pay for. So his sentence to the killer was to pay for the funeral of the man he had killed and to bring food to the widow's family every week for the rest of her life. So that was, I thought, a very wise and interesting decision. And there were maybe 30 people standing around our group kibitzing on the outside, you know, people from the community as he was telling us the story. And they were all nodding and talking to each other and sort of indicating that that's why they elected him president, is because he was sensible. We went from there to a church in another community and listened to this choir sing, the Zandi Youth Choir. And they were just wonderful. And then the 10 of us broke down into maybe six or seven. We each took six or seven of the kids in the youth choir and talked with them about their lives. And this was my group to find out what they thought about what was going on in South Africa and what their hopes for the future were. So my group told me, well, we had a wonderful conversation. It was maybe an hour long. We had they told me that a number of people in the youth choir have killed people because they're at war. And so they feel that they have to be warriors or soldiers. And I found it very unsettling because these were such sweet teenagers and they sang such beautiful religious music. And then to hear that there were people that had done killing and of course not been brought to trial because in that war situation, you don't do that, seemed unsettling to me, and it was something that I had to sort of deal with. One of the people in this group was among those people. Yes?
Are they killing other blacks or the whites?
I think probably both. They're fighting back when hostilers come and attack them, and I think they feel free to... I think there isn't much black on white, so they're probably just killing other blacks. There's just in the last month or two, there's been some blacks killing whites, but the numbers are very small. But these kids are so old beyond their years in some ways from living their whole lives in this situation. And one of the effects of the situation is that they have had such poor schooling and such little amount of schooling because the schools are often closed because of violence and fear, and their lives are so chaotic, they don't have food or, you know, the sort of bare necessities, so it's very difficult for them to keep moving through their childhood in any appropriate way at all. But boy, could they sing. Oh, they were just wonderful. It's too dark a picture, isn't it? But they sang and danced for us for an hour, and they were spectacular. They could have easily gone on the road in the United States. And then we went, I just put this in briefly to mention this. This guy was the vice president of Witwatersrand University. And he told the story of how that university has fought to include black students among the students in the university and how what a struggle it's been and how progressive that really is for a white university there and how the black students have really done pretty well. I'm a college teacher, so I was interested to hear, and they do have some sort of remedial work for them to get them up to speed, but basically they find them to be extremely able students, and as I said, they know five languages. So they have found that accepting the black students into the university has been, by and large, a very easy step for the university to take. They have not been less than able, even in spite of their terrible education as children. The amount of money spent on black schools in South Africa is about 1/15 per pupil than is spent on white students. So obviously that takes its toll. Then we went one day to another township, Alexander Township. If you read the stories in our press about South Africa, every so often there'll be a dateline from Alexander Township or from Alexander. And that is a place where the violence for some reason is particularly bad. There are lots of townships, there are lots of hostels there. And this is a hospital that was originally built for white folks, so it's very nice. And then the white folks built themselves a new hospital and gave this one to the black community, to Alexander Township, which is, you know, so one hospital for I don't know how many million people. But it's surrounded by hostels. So everybody, I guess that's why the white folks gave it away. Everybody who comes to this hospital takes their life in their hands because the hostelers shoot them and sometimes rape them. And so just getting to the hospital is a major feat of daring, actually. But once you're there, it's a wonderful hospital and the staff there are fabulous. This man had been imprisoned for 20 years. He's a doctor. He's the head of the hospital. He was imprisoned and tortured because he believed that black people should have some rights. And then around the same time as Mandela was released from prison, he was released. So he told us as a doctor that his prescription for himself was to not focus on that torture and that past, but to just plunge himself into work here. Work as hard as he could, and he thought he would recover from the effects of the torture and the 20 years of imprisonment.
Was the staff all black, all African?
Yes. Yeah. He is still talking to our group. I wish I'd put these in forward. I'm really sorry. The walls all throughout the hospital had instructional murals on them, so that they constantly were teaching people who came to the hospital through the murals on the walls how to raise children, or how to be what to eat while you're pregnant, or how to get over diarrhea, or what to do about if you have infection. And you know, I thought it was such a good idea to have the walls of a hospital, and it was in five units, and so each unit treated different kinds of problems. And the murals on the walls would change, depending, of course, so that you could learn about the situation you were there for. And here they're doing stuff on appropriate development and growth among children and babies.
Could the people read, or could they understand those without reading what's going on?
I think they could understand them without reading, but I think a lot of people can read a little, at least. This was the matron who was in charge of labor and delivery, and she talked about how, because there's been so much death, families don't have necessarily, like young pregnant women don't have their mothers necessarily to come and help them, or a sister. So in cases where the pregnant person would have to labor alone without family support, they have community women who they call, I've forgotten, but it's some kind of a mother word, some kind of a mother person, to come in and be the mother to the laboring young woman. And she said they found that when they have supportive people helping a woman labor, that she requires no medication, and that the labor goes faster, and that the experience is better, and the baby, everything comes out better. So they just routinely assume that laboring women need support and friendship and love and help. And so that's how it's organized, which uses the resources that they have, I think, in a very wise way. She was a lovely woman. They have that vehicle, so they can sometimes fetch people who've been hurt by guns, you know, mostly. They go and get them out of the streets and bring them into the hospital. But those are all hospital buildings. These are more of the hospital buildings. This is Tom Witt, who was our guide. His father, Tom's father, was the executive director of Holden Village for 5 years, Elmer Witt. And Tom has frequently been here and, in fact, lived here for several years. Then we were traveling to the Indian coast from the highlands where we'd been, and I just wanted you to see some of the changes and variations in the countryside in South Africa. I had no idea what a beautiful country this was, and it just, day after day, it just knocked my socks off, because it was so lovely. This is a dammed area to generate power. Then we went up into the countryside, into some basically Zulu land. And in the Zulu land, we met, the first few times we went into Zulu lands, we met with ANC supporters. And the Zulu people, the Zulu tribe, is the main support for the Inkatha political party. And the Inkatha are mainly held responsible and blamed for the black violence, black-on-black violence. And the Inkatha are talked about pretty universally among the South Africans that we met with as being the enemy, and they're the problem. And the Inkatha are vying for power once black can vote and the new government comes in. And it's, but they're only 5% of the black people, so it isn't expected that they'll have much political power through the vote. But these were ANC supporters in the middle of Inkatha land, and so they felt a little bit besieged because they were periodically attacked by the Inkatha. But this was a place where there were lots of missionaries, for one thing. You can pick out the missionaries in my pictures. For example, there's one. But it was a place where the people who lived on that land had been given the land that they were living on, so that they were just beginning to take some real steps to claim the land as their own, even though it was land that they hadn't lived on as tribal people for generations. They had been removed to it and plunked down there, but now they owned it. So they were starting to do some developmental work. But they were also under siege much of the time by the Inkatha people who lived in the hills around it. So there was war going on here in the midst of all of this hopeful stuff about developing their own land. This group of men, who are all from this community, were building a sewer because as volunteers, because they had been given the land in their own community, and so they now found it important and valuable to develop so that they could get rid of their waste and not be constantly becoming sick from it. So it was neat to me to see that all these men came out to work as volunteers to build this sewer so that their own community would be improved. These three girls were 16 years old, and I have a 16-year-old girl, so of course I was affected by them particularly, but I met them when I was just wandering through this same community on their way back to school after lunch, and I stopped to chat, and you know, they were very hospitable and pleasant, and I said, "Do you live with your parents?" And they got funny looks on their faces, and they said, "Well, no, they didn't live with their parents. Their parents had all been killed." They were from three separate families, not from this same village, but a neighboring village. But because the Inkatha had killed their whole entire family, they were the only survivors, each of them, this village took them in, built a mud hut for them, two rooms, raised enough money so that they could get school uniforms, and then from time to time contributes a little food to their livelihood. And so it was wonderful to me, and it was very typical of many stories I heard, that the black people in South Africa don't let other people fall through the net. They are each other's safety net, and communities come through for individuals in a way that I just don't witness much in the United States. It was a sad story, these 16-year-old girls trying to make it alone, but on the other hand, it was a real tribute to that community that they were cared for by the community. This is their kitchen, what you see is what you get, that's all there's to it. And then their bedroom had one narrow cot in it, and that was it. They had just washed their clothes, and their clothes were all out on the cot, so I saw that they each had two pairs of underwear and a skirt and a blouse. That was it. But they were nice kids, and I really felt for them. Whoops. Now, one day we went to a community, and we were hosted in that community by the principal of the local high school. And this community, like many communities throughout South Africa, was a community of displaced persons. For some reason, the white government just displaced people willy-nilly. Everybody seems to have been displaced. But about 20 years before, this community of people had been living in a wonderful valley called Ezekini, about 20 miles away from where they are now. And it was a beautiful, lush valley, and it had water, and it was good farming, and it was land that they had lived on for generations. And they were removed from that and plunked down here in Zululand, on land that was being used by Zulu farmers for grazing. So of course the Zulus resented these non-Zulu tribal people coming and taking up their grazing land. So it was bad to start with, but these folks had no choice. And then once they're here and some structures have been put up and they begin to live here, there's conflict and violence and bad stuff going on between this tribe and the Zulu tribe whose land they've taken. And the conflict in the last couple of years has escalated because the white government has started arming everybody. So there are all these AK-47s. You can go to South Africa and buy an AK-47 on a street corner for $25. But mostly they're just given to black folks to use. So this was this principal of the high school of this community, who was one of the displaced peoples, was our guide here. And he drove us into his community and he said, oh, there's a funeral going on. It turns out a few days earlier there had been violence between the Zulus and these people, and two young men here had been, or one man and one boy had been killed. So we saw the funerals going on for those two people. Here's a ANC flag that they're carrying while they're dancing the toy toy and wailing, you know, coming down the street. And the bodies were kept inside the houses of each of the people, but the funerals themselves were outside the house in the front on the street. There's the ANC flag, and the kids are dancing, you know, everybody's dancing the toy toy. You see that on television every so often when you see angry South Africans at funerals. And grieving very from the heart. I really think that expression of grief, for me, a sort of uptight Norwegian, it seems unreachable, but it looked to me like it must be good to grieve so wholeheartedly like that. Everywhere we went, we saw funerals, I mean graveyards, and the graveyards were all had so many fresh graves in them. It was just so unsettling. But this was, once we'd seen this one street with two funerals going on in it, then we drove in our van, we got back in the van with the headmaster of this school, and we drove past the cemetery for this town. And the headmaster, the cemetery was on the Zulu side of town, so these two guys that were dead couldn't be buried in this cemetery because it wasn't safe to go through the Zulu side of town, the Inkatha side of town, to bury them. So they, ordinarily South African poor folks, carry the bodies or the coffins to the nearby cemetery and bury them. But here they had to hire a truck to come and get these coffins and carry them off to some other cemetery that was safe to bury in. But our headmaster had buried his mother here 3 years earlier, and he hadn't dared go over there for almost 3 years to see her grave. So as we entered the Zulu side of town, this principal of the high school got down on the floor of our van and hid. And then when we got by the cemetery, he wanted us to tell him so that he could peek up over the edge and look out the window to see his mother's grave. And then here we are among the Zulu people, the Inkatha. And you know, these are the people we had been told were terrible people and we should fear them and hate them, and you know. And here was a little boy, he had a shield and a spear. But of course the Zulu people, the Inkatha people, were wonderful and they were very kind. And this says, enjoy life, with this boy sitting on the stone. You know, everybody does what they can to try to improve their own little place on earth. And these were some of the women there. And these women would not talk to us until we prayed for peace with them. So we all joined together in a prayer for peace. And these are the people that are being blamed for the violence, of course. But they were very clear they wouldn't speak about it until we'd all joined together to pray for peace. And then they would tell us what they thought. And we finally asked them, where are the men folk? Because there were children and women around, but not many men, just a few, very few men. And they said the men were all off at another funeral. One of their warlords had been killed in the same skirmish as the funerals we had seen a mile away. And so they were burying their dead the same time as the other community was burying its dead. And it just seemed to me to be so pointless somehow, the whole thing. So that was very sad, but we also found that these were very wonderful people, the Inkatha people that we met with. Then we went the same day, we drove 20 miles out in the country to the place where these people had all originally been removed from. So we saw the homeland that they wanted to go back to. And we learned that it had been in courts of law for years, going through appeals and stuff. But eventually now, just a couple of years ago, this homeland was returned to that tribe. People and tribes usually don't own separate little bits of land the way we do in this country, but the whole tribe owns all the land. And so this land, this beautiful valley which they had come from, is now theirs again. And a few people have moved back to it. So they're starting to build homes. You can see it, well, not there, but down the hill you can see a few homes. And some of the people from that tribe that have been living in that horrible township that where the funerals were going on now have moved back into their valley, and more people are moving back all the time. This is the valley. And the principal, the headmaster, was still with us, and he said that when he was raised here, I think the picture's backwards, so it's hard for me to figure out, but I think this tree was in his front yard. And so I said, well, there's no house there now. It turns out the government had completely razed every building except one wall, every building in the whole community. It had bulldozed down a college. We went and walked around the ruins of the college. You could see the foundation still of all these big buildings. Two regular schools, a grammar school and a high school, a community center, all of the homes. The whole community had been knocked down, so that this picture shows the one remaining wall of the college, but you can see some other foundational stuff around. It was just, it took the government a long time to do it. They said it took several years for them to completely knock down the whole village. But they succeeded in doing it, and now finally the people are going back to it. So, I think they wanted the land. It was so rich and it was good land. And
but they don't look like they were using it.
No, except grazing. I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. If we were told, it didn't sink in on me. But as we were there, it was late in the day, we brought picnic supper along and sat on this hillside and ate our supper and heard people from the community talk to us. And we saw from across the land people coming on horseback and walking in, and it's quite flat, so you can see people for a long distance. We noticed more and more people coming, and they would all stop down in here somewhere, go into a house, I've forgotten which one, and then they would walk off into these woods. And then pretty soon we heard incredibly beautiful music coming out of the woods, and it was eerie. It was so compelling. It was, if any of you know the musical group Ladysmith Black Mambazo, which I have some tapes of. It's a South African singing group that is touring here quite a bit these days and has been in a play that's playing in New York now. They're from this valley, and the music that we were hearing sounded like Ladysmith Black Mambazo. It was beautiful African music with great harmonies and complex harmonies and a wonderful beat. So I walked down there to see what it was. And it turns out it was our fourth funeral of the day. And it was a funeral of an old man who had come back home, lived in his own house, or lived in a house in his own land, died of natural causes, died as a man of Christian faith, and his own neighbors and friends and community had been surrounding him at the time of his death, and they were coming now for his funeral. And their cemetery is off in those woods. And so it was almost like at the end of the day, God gave us this vision of what life should be like. What's normal and natural and beautiful and a good part of life. And it was it stood in such stark contrast to the previous things we'd been seeing all day that it just reminded us, and the people here were so clear in their statement of what they want. They said what black people in South Africa want is their own land. That's all they want. They don't expect the government to come in and build or rebuild. They don't expect the government to do anything for them because they have very low expectations. What they do want is their own place to be, their own land. And then they'll do the developing themselves. And I think that lesson came home to us many days while we were there, but this was one of those days when it was so clear. When your own land meant even a place to bury your dead on your own land. You need a place to, you need your own land to be dead in as well as to be alive in. Then we flew to Cape Town, and Cape Town is just a spectacularly beautiful place. And one morning, we're not in Cape Town yet. This is in Durban, which is another place on the Indian Ocean. One morning, we went at 6 in the morning to the beach to see what we had heard about, which are religious groups coming to have baptisms. See if I can get it focused a little better. On the beaches. And so we went down to see what that was all about. And, you know, it was interesting because the regular life of a beach went on, and then there would be these religious groups going in and having a pastor and various people dunking in the water and much liturgy and stuff. That was a cross, that white stick up there. And I talked quite a lot with this woman. She said, in fact, these are not baptisms. These are services of renewal. She said, we feel every so often that it's wise for us to come and renew ourselves in the water after the fashion of our baptism because we feel cleansed by that. But also, we use it as a method of forgiveness. She said, many of us in our lives end up doing violent things, killing people and things like that. And here we can be cleansed and forgiven for that which we have to do in the liberation struggle. So they were quite beautiful people, and it was a very wonderful morning for me. I really ended up respecting them and liking them a lot. This is our group and one of their groups mixed together. The American, African Americans are these two guys that I was traveling with, and the rest of them are all from Africa. What else?
Fabulous dresses they have.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what we can do about the focus here, but. Then we spent a day, that same day after we'd gone to the beach at 6 in the morning, we went, got in our van and drove up into one of the Zulu territories to meet with some Inkatha people, leadership. And on the way up in there, it's so beautiful, but we saw lots of these farms that are called kraals, where there are circular buildings often, and they're very lovely farms. This is a typical one. Clay or mud buildings with that groups, and each building has a separate purpose.
What was that land?
That land is all KwaZulu, so it's owned by the Zulu tribes. Mm-hmm. And you can see why they want their own land. It's so beautiful, wonderful to live there, and they have resources and they can grow food, and the families can relate to each other in decent ways. I mean, this is the kind of thing that was destroyed for all the people who were displaced and put into townships. And then they starved to death. Then we got to the town where we were going, up in KwaZulu, and that we had written ahead that we were coming and we wanted to meet with the leadership of the community. So in Kata, people are well organized in the communities and they have structure, but they are also a people who are very threatened by their own structure. They're afraid of their leadership in some sense. So we got into this church, and at that time church was still in session, and so it was full, and the singing was beautiful. 4- and 8-part harmony automatically with everything. They had no hymn books. And all the women in the parish raised their hand and went but then they said, we know that you have asked to come and meet with our leadership. We have decided as a community that you will meet with the whole community instead of with the leadership. What would you like to know? And so then the 10 of us kind of looked at each other and thought, oh dear, now what are we? So two of the people I was traveling with were doctors, and one of the doctors raised her hand and said she would like to know what the problems, the health care problems were in their community. And the whole parish just went up for grabs. There was just pandemonium in the parish. All of a sudden they just totally ignored us and talked to each other in a very loud and animated way for about 5 minutes. And we wondered what we had done. We had asked about the healthcare problems in the community, and they just suddenly broke out into this huge discussion. And then finally, one old man, I think he's in this group. I don't think he's here still, but one man who at that time was sitting over here stood up and said, I am an old man. And then there was sort of a buzz that went through the parish again. He said, because I am an old man, I am going to tell you the truth. And immediately somebody else in the room stood up and said, you better not do that. That's not a good idea. You know, don't do it. And this man said, I am an old man and I am going to tell the truth. He said, we cannot answer your question about health care in this community because to answer the question would be to criticize our government. And so then there was much discussion again about this within the group, and we realized the mistake we'd made. So then the doctor who had asked the question originally rephrased the question by saying, do you have a hospital here? Which was a matter of fact, and it wasn't a matter of interpretation or a negative kind of thing. And they said, yes, they had a hospital, or no, they didn't. I guess they did, no, they didn't. But anyhow, then they were sort of trying to teach us how to ask questions that would not require them to say critical things about the leaders in the government, because if they did, they would get in trouble. And the reason they had decided the whole community would meet with us instead of just the leadership was so that everybody would see that there was nothing secret going on here with these white people from North America coming and who knows what was going on. So we learned a lot of lessons that day about the fear that a number of the Akata people have of Buthelezi and of the whole KwaZulu structure that they live within. Finally, people began to drift out and left because they saw that nothing secret was going to happen. And so it did end up being the leadership of the community, but it was because it had started as an open process. This woman was the oldest woman present, and she was the head of the Women's Association. And so at the end of our formal meeting with these people, which lasted several hours, the meeting couldn't end until these guys asked her if she would give the final statement. And so she walked up in front and she stood there and spoke for about 15 minutes, summarizing what had been said and talking about the future and sort of giving the benediction to the whole program. And then afterwards, she talked about their women's association and the problem they were having feeding the children, that the children were dying of starvation because they didn't have enough, they were cut off from many sources. The war was taking its toll, the drought was taking its toll. They didn't have their usual resources to feed their families. And so I belong to a women's group in Chicago, and I gave her some money, and I said, this is from my women's group to your women's group. And it was sort of a nice connection there at the end. There's some of the women.
Ingrid?
Yes?
Was part of the
attitude toward their own leadership due to the fact that they consider them quislings?
Yes, I think so. It's interesting that those KwaZulu people, who are the one tribal people who are cooperating with the white government, receive the lowest per capita income for their schools and for their health care from the white government. And so there's much violence within the community. So it's a very complex situation. We felt like we were in a tinderbox.
You were.
Those were the Lutheran missionaries in that community. I don't know why this doesn't focus better. This machine has a mind of its own. And that was the cemetery in that community. I've never been in a cemetery with so many fresh graves as I saw everywhere I went in South Africa. Oh, then we did go to Cape Town, and now I have a few nice slides of Cape Town just to show you how beautiful it is. We went down to the Cape. Right here, actually, there are some monkey, and there's another monkey there. There were some monkeys on the top of those rocks up at the top there. And the Cape itself, this is the tip of South Africa. This is where the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean come together. And it's just so beautiful. There, I got way out on the tip so I could take a picture, and you can see the mixing of the two waters. Then in Cape Town, we met with this man who was a Catholic priest named Basil van Rathbone. And he had led Cape Town is divided up into districts, and District 6 is one of the most desirable physically districts in Cape Town. And Cape Town is a spectacularly beautiful city, and beautiful old homes, and just really nice. But the government had decided to vacate District 6 because it was filled with colored people. Some of Indian descent and some black and white mixed. And they wanted to reclaim the land for white people because the city had grown and the city center had grown enough that the white folks didn't have enough room. So they began to bulldoze block by block all of District 6. And Father Basil had a huge parish right in the middle of the district. So he and a group of community leaders banded together to try to fight the dissolution of District 6. That woman is the principal of the high school of that same parish. And that's Table Mountain outside of Cape Town. This is the side wall of the parish. An artist in the community painted the story of the whole struggle to keep District 6 from being demolished. And we went through square by square. Each square has a story attached to it, and then there's a big center thing with a dove. And I have notes on all the symbolism of everything in it, but it means an awful lot to the people in that community, and that mural is over 20 years old now. They lost the battle. The immediate battle, because District 6 is where all the empty spaces are now. It's a whole vacant area, and then it goes uphill, much vacant land uphill too. But the people were so determined to keep new white structures from moving in that they have continually sabotaged any attempt to build in District 6 for 20 years. And the only thing that's been built is this new stuff, which is built by a labor union, and they allowed that to be built because it was for laborers. And so it's a successful battle because now, once again, the battle has been won in the courts and the people have been allowed to return. And so now they've all been sent to a very ugly place called the Sand Flats outside of Cape Town, where they're living in prefab housing in terrible conditions, and it's ugly and horrible. And they were all, the, just people in District 6 were all fisher people. They fished. And the sand flats are a long way from any possibility of fishing. And so they lost their professions as well as their homes. But now there are many meetings going on to decide who's going to move back. And some of the old people who lived all their lives here say they don't want to come back because it should belong to the young, and the young should come back and start to build, and the younger families. And but as Father Basil said, it's a very healthy set of discussions that's going on now, and then they're going to start building housing for people so they can come back to District 6. There's Father Basil talking some more.
Was his church building spared?
Yes, it's interesting. All the churches were spared, including the mosques. And they said the mosques were spared because the white government in Cape Town didn't want to risk losing their oil supply. But in District 6, there were the seven, it's the town square of it was the seven stone stairs, and that's where everybody would gather every day for gossip and community stuff. And Father Basil saved the seven stone stairs and piled them in the front of his, in the front entrance to the church, and they're waiting now to be reinstalled in the new District 6. But this is where the people from District 6 were sent. And they live in these places, and then in the backyards of all the places, there's squatter stuff, because that's the only space they have to expand into. In this place where they were sent, they did build a mosque, and they built several churches. But as you can see, it's just unredeeming, unremitting, ugly, flat. It's too dry to garden, hopeless land. This is the head of the community organization there in this place where they were sent. Her name is Carol Jackson, and those are two of her friends. Carol Jackson is the woman in the middle, in case you couldn't guess which one was the leader. But she's a very powerful woman, and she's really organizing this whole community of people and helping them think about how to get back to District 6 and how to maintain some level of sanity where they are living. This was the community organization that hosted us and showed us around the sand flats where they live. This was a group of homeless people who lived in the sand flats that had lived in Cape Town in District 6. This was a gang there. It's interesting that the gangs there are just like the gangs in Chicago. They do hand signs and the whole, you know, symbols, and wear their hats certain ways. And this group of boys who were very, each one of them had visible physical damage on their bodies. Like this boy was burned through here, and one of them that was on a cane. And, you know, they all had been damaged in various ways from violence. And we asked them who their enemy was. And they pointed right across the yard to the next hostile building over and said, the boys in that building are our enemy. You know, they just fight. Their lives are so miserable. They have such a strong sense of turf. It reminded me so much of the street gangs in Chicago. It's the same senseless violence and killing of people that they should be friends with. And then there was a creche in this place that I thought was wonderful, that babies were all taking their naps. But daycare centers are called creches there, and you see them everywhere.
How do you spell it?
C-R-E-S-C-H-E, I think. Or creche, like a Christ's creche.
Oh.
See, how is that spelled?
C-R-E-C-H.
Yeah. But aren't they beautiful? Those are colored babies, and that's a category of people in South Africa. It's black and colored and white. And then the last thing we did in South Africa, and I didn't bring my best slides, I grabbed the wrong pile, was we went to a conference given by the ANC for all of their international supporters. And ANC had never before been able to host all of the people around the world who had supported the right to the black people in South Africa to freedom and to the end of apartheid. So this was a very festive, wonderful occasion. It was a 3 or 4 day conference, and people flew in from 80 countries around the world, and it was an enormous room that it was in, a huge conference center, and they just wanted to update people on the progress and the talks toward ending apartheid. It had been in the newspaper for several days before the conference that Mandela was ill and that he would not be able to do any speaking for the next 3 weeks. His doctor had ordered him into his bed. He was exhausted. He had to stay in bed. And so he was supposed to be the keynote speaker at the conference, and they announced that he couldn't come. So Oliver Tambo gave the keynote speech and then many interesting speeches, and it was a very rich time. The second morning, about halfway through the morning, there was someone talking from the podium, and all of a sudden someone else walked up behind the speaker and whispered something, and the speaker stopped in mid-sentence and sat down. And then all of a sudden a bunch of African women started to sing and dance, and in walked Mandela. And he was in a Serafina t-shirt. It's a bad picture, I'm sorry, but it was an electrical moment. It was just wonderful. He got up out of his sick bed and came in, and he gave a speech. I tried to take notes on the speech, but I couldn't because I was crying. It was so beautiful. He said, "I couldn't stay in my bed knowing that all of you were here when the reason that we're going to end apartheid is because the international community kept the spotlight on this country and wouldn't let it go away. You all fought for our liberation when we couldn't do anything from inside because we were all banned and you could never meet with more than one other person." And he said, "For the 20-some years that I was in prison, you kept the spotlight on that prison so that people couldn't forget me and they couldn't murder me." So it was a speech of thanks to the international community for all the work that people had done in places like Holden Village for all those years to try to end apartheid there. And it was really wonderful. He's such a leader. I mean, the man is maybe 80 years old, and he's really tall. He's like 6'3 or something. And he was just in a t-shirt and pants, and he looked very tired. But he was so moving. Everybody in the whole room was just electrified by him. So that was quite wonderful, but I don't have good slides of it, I'm sorry to say. Then we left South Africa and went to Namibia. What time is it now?
10 after 12.
I can keep talking. We can go on. I can tell you about our visit to Namibia, or we could quit now and I can do Namibia another time. So I'd be interested in what you think about it. You're cold. Put my sweater. Okay, I'll go ahead and I'll share my sweater. No, you're okay? Should I get you? She can have my sweater if you want.
No, okay. Be cold.
Namibia is what used to be called Southwest Africa, and it was under the rule of the white government in South Africa for many, more than 50 years, I'm not sure how long, but maybe 100 years. And it has had apartheid all that time. Apartheid has been the rule of the land. And Namibia is the country, when the Christians divided up Africa, that was given to the Lutherans. So, you know, we, all us white folks, think we have all these rights to decide things like that, and somehow the Baptists got somebody, and the Methodists got something, and the Presbyterians got something, and the Lutherans got Namibia. So it's a Lutheran country. And it is, on the 21st of March this year, it was 3 years into liberation. 3 years ago, the 21st of March, it was liberated from South Africa, and it stopped being called Southwest Africa and began to be called Namibia. So we got to see what the difference is after 3 years of liberation, the contrast between living still under apartheid as the rule of the land and living in a place where apartheid had been dismantled and where everybody had the right to vote. So it was a very interesting study in contrasts for us. This, for example, is a township right outside of Windhoek, which is the capital of Namibia. And it's all built with government funds, and it's housing for black people. And it doesn't look like a squatter community. It looks much better. It's not heaven, but it's a lot better than they used to have. So the government is spending a lot of money just to build housing for people. And there is some squatter housing still, but it's just, it just has a different feel to it. It feels like it's sane. And I think there's water in all of these. There's not electricity. Oh, even, yeah, there is some electricity. See, they're electrified. They don't all have running water, but some of them do. So that is one change that having a black government has made. Even the squatter communities are nicer. That's a squatter community in Namibia, in Windhoek. And it just doesn't feel so oppressive. Of course, it isn't as crowded. There are fewer people there. These are bathrooms. Things like this with essentially black plastic bags around them. Can't see it really, but it's a thing that maybe comes chest high. Here's another one. And has a hole dug under it. And that's a typical bathroom structure for. And then, as you can see, that if the toilet has a hole dug under it, there's no plumbing under that. I mean, there's no sewer or anything, so that's not very healthy. But at least it's outside the house, and it's there's some measure of control on it. It's not heaven. I mean, Namibia is an extremely poor country. Oh, that's upside down. No, it's backwards. Namibia Women's Center, it says, and the government has funded it. So the government decided that, the new black government in Namibia decided that the problems women were having in Namibia as a result of the war in particular, violence, rape, domestic abuse, children's issues, were so serious that they needed to build women's centers. So this is the Windhoek Namibia Women's Center. There you can, that's more of the Women's Center. They offer classes in domestic arts and in child raising and in various ways to make money, like weaving, and in whatever kind of classes the women feel they would benefit from. And they also have some child care. This is another creche in one of those township buildings with lots of little kids. And I think this one had 40 children and two or three women staffing it. But the children in Namibia seem more organized, better cared for, not so many just at random on the streets. There were community organizations, like this is a SWAPO building, that were there to help people. So one thing we noticed was that in Namibia there was much more overt, clear help, places to go if you have problems, funded by the government. This man, Kamita, Reverend Kamita, is a Lutheran pastor. He's black, he's albino, who is the Martin Luther King of Namibia. And he is a wise, wise, smart, sensible man. He's an absolutely wonderful man. And he's been a Lutheran pastor all his life. And his adult life, he was asked by the people to run for parliament once Namibia got its independence. And so he sort of reluctantly was dragged into the political life, and he was elected to parliament. And then once in parliament, he was immediately elected the head of it. So he's the chair of the parliament, and he said his skills as pastor have served him well as a parliamentarian, because he has to be nice to people on all different sides of issues, and he has to be even-handed and fair, and he has to make peace among people. But boy, he talked to our group for a couple of hours, and he was just mesmerizing. He's just a wonderful, wonderful man. And many people think that he'll be the next president of Namibia.
What's the population of Namibia?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. Didn't look to me like very many people lived there.
It's not a big geographic area.
Well.
Something like a state?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a big state, like California. Probably there's Kamita again. He has a personal presence and, you know, integrity and charisma that is really quite stunning. This man is a tribal chief, and tribal chiefs have come into the 20th century, so they don't look like tribal chiefs you might visualize, but here he was in his office in southern Namibia, and they're having a terrible drought. The drought now has ended, but when we were there in February, you know, the drought that has been going on for years in the sub-Sahara Africa is affecting Namibia. And this man, who what we thought was a very wise and sensitive and kind man, was telling us with much anguish the effect of the drought on his people and his tribe. And then he invited us to go out into the countryside and meet with some of the people in his tribe. So we did that. And this was one family we met with. These are the Harari tribal people. And the woman in the pink hat was the matriarch. And these are several of her daughters. Here's a, it's backwards, you know, but this is a woman with a, happens to have a map of Africa on her dress. And this is Namibia, the blue. So there's the answer to your question, sort of. This family of mostly women told us about their lives and the effect of the drought on their lives. They said the drought has really been, they haven't had good rain since 1984, and so they mostly eat goat. They eat goat, boiled goat soup, and goat meat, and goat milk, and goat everything. But they say even when they plant the corn in the riverbed, there's no water and the corn won't grow. And corn is normally the staple of their life. So they said that the men had all years ago gone off to the city to try to make money because they couldn't have their normal life because of the drought. They couldn't farm and there was nothing for them to do. And then they said that in the city, the men all have become alcoholics. They can't find work and they drink. So they feel like their family has been destroyed by the drought because the government didn't have resources to help them, and the menfolk have been all divided from the family. So they think that there's a sickness that even when the drought ends will not be a sickness that they can recover from. This is one of the grandchildren and great-grandchildren in their home. This is their home. There are some of the great-grandchildren. Of course, they're adorable. But even in the midst of this, I had to say, Al, you'll be interested in this, I had to say that I saw beautiful things. My eyes would find beauty many places, in every place I went. Everyone made their own implements. They made their own pots in these countryside places, and they were made beautiful pots. So the human spirit is pretty persistent. But that's their home. Then we went to another town in Namibia, and this man became our host for the day. And he took us into his aunt, that's his aunt, and he took us to visit her. And she took a liking to us, and so we were invited into her kraal, K-R-A-A-L, kraal, which is her farm. And we normally you're just invited into the front yard of a kraal, but we got to go, at least I and a couple of other women got to go into many of those round huts and see what it was like. So she was a wonderful woman. She was so much fun. And I have pictures of her kraal, which is those are two buildings there. She's a weaver. She made that. In fact, I bought that from her and took it home. And she was a weaver and a potter and a goat tender. And she was the matriarch of this kraal. Yeah. They're her goats. This is her meat drying room, because that's all they have to eat. They dry the meat and then in this room, and then they cook it in another room. They have a kitchen house. That's the kitchen house. This is the room for grinding wheat and corn. And because they're having the drought, there's nothing in it. But they ordinarily would use this post to make a meal in this hole. They would put the corn in there and then grind it so that they would have cornmeal to bake with. And you can see there's nothing stored in there. Ordinarily they would have corn stored in there, but they don't have any because of the drought. And there she is. And she made those pots. She decided that she and I looked alike. She said we have the same cheekbones and I forget what else. So she wanted our picture taken together. So you can see how much we look alike.
Is that her kids or her?
She's holding a pot, I think. No, those are her pants. That's her knee, yeah. Yeah, that's
so. Where do they get that food? Do they just not eat a balanced diet?
They don't eat a balanced diet. And many of them die. Children die all the time. And that's her crawl from a distance. It's a very big crawl. She has a big extended family. They were all off doing something. I don't know what.
Is that her band in front there that looks like it's been killed?
Yes.
So that's where she wanted.
But I don't think it is tilled. I mean, I think that's where the goats walk, and I don't think they're really trying to grow anything there because it hadn't rained yet.
Yeah.
But it was just, the drought was just ending when we were there, and you can see the clouds gathering. Every afternoon the clouds would gather, and then eventually they did rain. Mm-hmm. So they were really praying for rain. It was the rainy season, and it was supposed to be raining. And so they were hoping they could grow something. Maybe it was tilled then, because maybe they were getting ready for the rain. This woman was a head of a women's organization there, but she has been through seminary and wants to be ordained as an Episcopal pastor. But the Episcopal Church in South Africa has decided that women can be ordained, and Tutu, Desmond Tutu, is the head of that. Her local bishop in Namibia will not accept women for ordination. And Desmond Tutu is a friend of hers and has told her he will ordain her if she'll come to South Africa. But she says no, she wants to stay in Namibia and work, and she wants her local bishop to deal with it. So she's just waiting for ordination. She's an extremely wonderful, fun person, and she was not heavy-spirited or oppressed by this, but she was just energized and a good fighter, and meanwhile was working for this women's organization, doing very good things. But I hope her bishop sees that she will make a wonderful pastor. This was in the north of Namibia. I wish I could remember the name of the town, but I can't. But it's where a Lutheran bishop is that has actually been to Holden, I think. But this was a bank. And the bank was bombed during the war, and a bunch of people were killed, including the daughter of this Lutheran bishop. She was just in line at a teller, you know, when a bomb went off. And the people have decided never to rebuild this bank because they want it to stand as a reminder of the war and as a testimonial to the horror of war and a reminder to never again get into war. So it's quite a famous bank, and I think it's probably a good idea. Now, this is sad that these pictures are backwards, but we went to a wonderful school. In contrast with the school at the beginning of my slideshow, this will be the school at the end of it. A wonderful school in Namibia where the children are well cared for, the school is well cared for, and the kids had made a set of murals outside the school. And the murals were so beautiful, but this, as you can see, was a sword through the plowshare one, starting with a gun and then a few leaves on it and a few more leaves. And then the gun becomes a flowering tree and the flowers are Namibia. So so they want the violence to have gone. The images that the kids came up with were, and this says March 21, 1990, which was Liberation Day, the day that Namibia became liberated. So this would have been a much more effective picture if I just turned it around for you so you could see it. But I'll show you some more of the mural. Let's see if we can figure out these words. Freedom for everyone, that says up there. Anybody good at this?
Together.
Together.
Now, both abolish apartheid, brothers and sisters.
Abolish apartheid, brothers and sisters. School children did all this. You know, they had resources and teachers and stuff compared to that school that you saw earlier where there were so few resources. You know, this animal just sort of joyously upside down and dancing. Our new home, A-N-D, I don't know, I can't read backwards. But the whole idea was that they were celebrating independence. There it says, independence mural. Namibia
Nation.
So these kids know what's what. They're white and black together.
After a long struggle, Namibia is free at last.
Yes, after a long struggle, Namibia is free at last. This was the school from the inside. It's called the People's Primary School, and it's a Christian school, and it's funded in part by funds from international people. I think actually Holden has been involved in funding it some. I'm not positive of that, but it seems to me it's true. There is a woman who's a Lutheran missionary who works here, among others, and it's started by some international people, but it's just been taken over by Namibian people. Now there are 1,300 students in it, 300 of whom are orphans, so they live at the school and the teachers care for them. But it's a really beautifully run, wonderful school, and the kids are terrific, and they all look healthy and happy, and they were very wonderful and fun with me, and I felt like they were in a good place, even though I was very sad for 300 of them to be there as orphans. They sang Namibian songs for me, and they were obviously enjoying them. So, that's it. We met, one other little story about Namibia. We met with the president and vice presidents of the University of Namibia.
India.
And the University of Namibia is the first and only university in Namibia, and until independence, Namibia had no university. So anybody who went beyond high school in Namibia went out of the country. But now the government knows that it's important to build a university there, and so they are thinking about what do you do if you're building a university from scratch? What's important to think about? What do you value? And they discussed it with us. They said, we don't want to lose what's valuable about our culture and our history, so we want to be sure to have that cared for in the university. We don't want to make our people into Westerners because they're not Western, they're African, and we want to have our people ready to deal in the 21st century. So have people smart, well-educated. So we've decided that some parts of the education of our young people have to be left to other countries. And so if you want to study certain subjects for advanced degrees, you'll have to leave Namibia and go elsewhere. We can't do everything. We have limited funds and only one university in the country. But one of the things we really need to figure out is what do we want to nourish about a free and independent Namibia that can go back to our healthy roots, and what do we want to minimize or not teach our young people. It was an interesting set of questions that had. They were so thoughtful. All these black leaders, none of whom had been educated in their own country, they had all been lucked out somehow, gone to London or the United States or somewhere else to be educated. But now they were all just focused on what is the best thing for Namibia. And I just loved it. I just thought it seemed so appropriate and healthy somehow. And they were not anti-white, but they just were clear that blacks were the leaders. So, thank you. Yeah.
Does it seem that apartheid is making progress? That, getting rid of it so that there will be democracy in Africa? You think we're moving along?
Well, I think it will come. The violence is increasing. There's more violence. And the horrors that are happening are greater. And the resistance is greater. The white conservatives, we met with the white conservatives in Parliament, and they said they're going to arm themselves and shoot if they don't get a white apartheid, a white homeland. They want a separate place for white people to live. And if the blacks are in government, they won't live there. They said they'll go to war. So the future is going to be rough. And the other thing we learned over and over again, both in South Africa and in Namibia, but particularly in Namibia, which is 3 years out of apartheid, is that everybody said to us, apartheid worked. We're still separated from each other. We still mistrust each other. We're still living, the legacy of apartheid is very much alive among us. It will take centuries to get rid of it. But then they would always say, for example, look at you in the United States. How long since you got rid of slavery? Do you still have apartheid or not in your hearts? So they have, but they're facing that head on. They're trying to deal with it. And they said that the poison of apartheid is still among us, but we are working to get rid of it. One township we were in, the people were forced to write their tribal letter on their front door of their house, H or Hararo or whatever tribe they were. And on the day of liberation, the 21st of March, 1990, everybody went out with paint cups and painted out their tribal designation so that they could start to break down those barriers and start to become one people. Well, I appreciate your attention and tolerance for this sort of disorganized slideshow, but thank you for coming.
Thank you.